Welcome to Two Way Street. The Indigo Girls may be one of the country's most popular musical singer-songwriter teams, but for those of us who've been around Georgia for several decades, we feel a special pride in being able to say we knew them when. Emily Saliers and Amy Ray first met in elementary school in Decatur. They went through high school together and began playing local stages long before they achieved national success. To this day, an Indigo Girls concert in Atlanta has a warmth and nostalgic pull like a homecoming, reuniting the Saliers Ray tribe for an evening reminding us of how much they've meant to our lives for so many years. It took Emily a long time to decide she wanted to do a solo record, but now Murmuration Nation is out, and she's beginning a national solo tour to promote the album. As she was ramping up to go on the road, we invited her to bring her guitar into the Two Way Street studio to talk about and sing from the new record and to tell stories about her life in music. Emily, what a pleasure to have you here in the Two Way Street studio. Thanks for coming in.
Bill, you're an Atlanta institution.
No, you're an Atlanta
institution. I wouldn't say no to you. I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
So, Emily, what's really exciting is to get an opportunity to talk to you about this new record, Murmuration Nation. And we're going to talk in a minute about what that title represents. It's pretty interesting in and of itself. But you and Amy Ray have been playing together since you were like in high school.
That's right.
Right. And so that was back in the early 80s.
Yep.
And here it is, 2017. Amy's released a number of solo albums, and this is your first solo record. What took you so long?
I'm a late bloomer and a slow mover. I think largely everything that I did with Indigo Girls satisfied the creative thing that I needed to do, and I had some outside creative things. I wrote a book with my dad, which we'll talk about, I think, and then done some co-writes and just sung unplayed on other people's records. And so there was enough, you know. But then gradually I really started to think that I wanted to do a solo record that was more rhythmic centric. I've been very influenced largely by hip hop and rap and African American gospel, R&B, my whole entire life, you know. My first record was the Jackson 5 I bought myself. And so black music.
Which album was it?
I think the album was called I Want You Back. It cost $5. And my dad said he knew I wanted to buy this album and I was really young. I had no money. So he's like, pick some dandelions out of the yard. He created a task. I'll give you a penny for every dandelion. And I picked 500. Which was just enough money, $5, to get the record. So that was my first purchase. I was over the moon. But anyway,
do you remember a song from that record that's still in your memory? I mean, this isn't a test, but do you remember a song from that record?
I want you back. Dun 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 dun. I want you back. Trying to live without you, girl.
You're the one on the blizzard. Let me show you, girl.
And the rhythm just was like, you know, in me. So Indigo Girls aren't really a groove. We use rhythm, obviously, bass and drums in all the recordings, but we're not really a groove band. If any of it is groove, it's probably come from me and a few of my songs. I could think of one or two, for example. But I start this pull to do a record that included like thoughtful lyrics, hip hop influence without appropriating it, because you know I'm not a hip hop artist, but it moves me. So bring some of those elements in and beats and so on. And so then Lyris Hung, who produced the album, was playing violin with me and Amy on the road. And I sent her just a couple of samples of songs, and she had a studio at her house, and she produced them. And the way that she produced them, it was like a light bulb went off. And I was like, okay, there's no doubt that this is the person to help me make that record. And that was the catalyst. It still took us 3 years from the first time I asked her.
It's interesting because you told Paste Magazine, for instance, that this was a scary proposition for you. You call yourself something of an introvert, which I find interesting considering how much time you spend on stage entertaining people and do it with such exuberance. But here you are alone, and I think you told them that your first thought was, where's Amy when I need her? How do talk about that?
Well, especially in these first few solo shows that I'm doing, it's just, you know, I have the insecurities of I'm only one voice, I'm not two voices. I don't have the yin yang that Amy and I have together, which is so gratifying for me. And I think I can speak for her as well. But, you know, it's just basic artistic insecurities, and I have them like everybody else. And so it was those feelings of like, people aren't going to like this because it's different from Indigo Girls, and there's not as much harmony, and where's all the acoustic guitar, and just things like that, which is dangerous for an artist when you think outside of what you're just particularly focused on in front of you and what you feel like creating, and you start thinking about how it's going to be perceived. It's just, it just stops you in your tracks.
You know, you made an interesting point. We are so used to Indigo Girl tracks that feature you and Amy heavily on guitar. It's one of the things that we love in the sound of the Indigo Girls, mm-hmm. Is that guitar. Mm-hmm. And you've pulled the guitar way back in this record. How does that feel?
Lyris made me do it. I had a lot of leap of faith moments where Lyris is like, look, you've written this guitar part, like for instance, at the beginning of OK Corral, and you put a delay on it, but it sort of sets it in a locked place. I want to take the guitar out and put this like spooky keyboard thing. It's gonna feel more contemporary and it's gonna speak to the song better. And I was like, but I wrote it on guitar. So we had a lot of these conversations. In the end, Lyris is an orchestrator and she puts musical pieces in their places and nothing is kind of layered on top of each other without purpose. So there were a lot of moments where in the end, you know, I accepted her vision and I'm glad I did. And the reason why I didn't want to at first was because I was clinging on to what I was used to. And so in that way, this is very different from an Indigo Girls record. So all the songs were written on guitar, but only one or two the ukulele songs I played all the way through, Poet Hearted, Slow Down Day Friend. But Train Inside is really the only song that I played all the way through on an acoustic guitar.
Interesting. You're beginning a really big tour around this record. Are you nervous when you walk on stage without Amy standing next to you still?
I'm not nervous, but I feel particularly humbled. I really do. I feel excited because at this point in my life and my career, to be able to do something brand new, I just feel so grateful for it. And I'm very energized, you know. I'm always calling my management and I'm like, what can we do? What can we do? And they're like, chill, you know. We know what to do. We'll all be together.
Let's talk about the record. Because, okay. I mean, really specifically about the music on the record. Is it okay with you?
Of course.
Murmuration Nation. Tell us what a murmuration is.
Well, technically speaking, or naturally speaking, it's a flock of starlings. But it also refers to these massive flocks of starlings that shape-shift, turn on a dime, and these beautiful motions where the blackness comes together thickly and then disperses. And, I mean, visually, it's stunning. And then if you think about them in flight, I saw this as a metaphor for the way that social change is happening in this country right now, particularly as a result of the presidential election and the divisions in our country. And so I saw this is a new way. It's against a patriarchal system of change. There aren't any bosses. You know, we're exchanging ideas. Communities of privilege, people of privilege are starting to listen to people of color or different peoples. And that's what I saw the murmuration as. And it's, yeah, so that's it.
You just said it. It's an entire community of starlings. No one bird is leading. They are all somehow working together and flying these remarkable patterns together in harmony. Isn't that fascinating?
To me, it was just like undeniable. I was like, I love blackbirds. I love birds, all birds, but particularly blackbirds for whatever reason. And then I just thought after the election that metaphor came to me and I was like, got to do this. And yeah, so I think murmurations are powerful. And I've heard and read that these murmurations may be to ward off prey. So if in fact that's the case, it's just another level of the metaphor.
Well, the title of the record, we hear it in the lyric of the song Fly. Could we just listen to a little bit of that right now and then let's talk about it?
Yes, we've been hit by a sucker punch, minding the business of progress. There was a bad one in the bunch, rubbing our jaws, rising up slowly from the dust, shaking our heads and wondering what you
just happened to us. I've spent all my life thinking we could have a meeting of our minds. When I was a child, I fought like a child.
And now Fly. And you've always been a pretty active political person, and so this song is in many ways, you've indicated essentially, a response to the Trump presidency. You start by saying we've been hit by a sucker punch.
I know lots of people, I know lots of white people who couldn't get out of bed. I know lots of black friends who said, are you kidding? This definitely could have happened. This isn't really a surprise to us. It got me thinking. And really, that election was the end of an innocence that I had about we can all come together, sort of a 60s peace and love sort of thing, because I realized that divisions and ideologies, and this is a huge country, you know, 300 million plus people, and it is too naive to think that we can all come together, sort of a heaven on earth. And that was the end of that innocence.
Yeah, that's election. Why I wanted to let that play, because of the lyric, I've spent all my life thinking we could have a meeting of the minds. You want a nice little fun fact about starlings? Maybe you already know this.
Yeah, I do.
You know they're not indigenous to the United States?
I did not know that.
Do you know how they were introduced to this country?
No.
A group of Shakespeare lovers in New York City had decided right around the turn of the 20th century that Central Park should be populated by every species of bird mentioned in Shakespeare's work. And that's how the starling ended up in this country.
You're kidding.
No, it's a true story.
I totally missed that.
I just thought that was a little fact that you might enjoy knowing
that.
About.
That is, I'll have to write a song about that now.
Can we just talk about a few of the other songs on the record? One of them that's really interesting is a song, it's the song Long Haul. And one of the things that's interesting about it is you brought an old friend of yours to the studio who I think you initially just planned on having do a little backup vocal for you. Talk about it.
Well, it's the great Jennifer Nettles, who, as you Atlantans know, grew up in the Atlanta music scene. And so our paths crossed at Eddie's Attic in Decatur. She was in her own Jennifer Nettles band. We became friends with the music scene. And then when Kristen Hall and Christian Bush formed Sugarland and brought her on, they just skyrocketed, and we all knew they would. She's a lovely person and an old friend. And she's very busy and very successful now. And so I was just a text, and I said, will you come sing on the record? And she was like, of course. So she walked in, and it was just going to be background singing, I thought. But then she just, like, inhabited the song Long Haul and turned it into a duet.
Let's listen to just a little of it.
We're a long haul, honey. The road is rugged and smooth. Sometimes we're deep in the groove, and then we fall out. But we're in it. Woo-hoo, that's how it felt when the open road first made a way for us.
Every song, the Hallelujah Chorus, we were on our way. You know what I think's interesting about that?
What?
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like an Indigo Girls song, and maybe it's just because Jennifer Nettles is there with you, but it sounds like a song Sugarland might have recorded a number of years ago.
I mean, she just puts her stamp on everything in the best way, but interestingly enough, she has a big, strong, booming voice, and I don't. But I feel like the blend is really good on this song, which was interesting to me. You never know how it's going to work out in reality, but she just came in like a boss and just did it. And the other thing is that when you have a person that you love or a friend that sings or plays on your record, and then it becomes indelible in that project, I can't tell you what that feels like inside. So forever, ever, if we last that long, well, I listen to this song and there's Jennifer. It's like, ah, that's my friend. And she helped me create this. And it's a beautiful gift.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Emily Saliers.
Poet hearted, outproduced and way outsmarted, short of tools for sure. Oh, you poet hearted, you dream like an engine but you never get started. What's all that paper on your floor? And you wonder how it got dark.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Emily Saliers. For more than 30 years, she's been half of one of the most beloved musical duos in the country, the Indigo Girls. Now, Emily's released her first solo record called Murmuration Nation.
I want to play a little more music from the record before we talk about other things. One of the things that you have always done is, no matter what, you have songs that are deal with social justice issues, but you and Amy have also written songs that I think are just beautiful romantic songs. Tell me if I'm wrong, but one of the songs on this album that I think comes closer, well, there are a few, but the one that really moves me a lot is Match.
Oh, that's interesting.
Why?
Well, it's co-written by Kristen Hall.
Oh, it was?
Yes, from Sugarland.
Yeah, yeah. You want to listen to just a little bit of it?
Yeah, yeah. You can try to hide your fears from me, but can't deny the chemistry. Come on. I know lonely leaves and awful scar, a miracle we got this far. Come on. Light the match, burn the room. This is the sound.
That's just really
I love
beautiful,
that. That's one of my
Emily.
Favorite tracks on the record.
Well, you know, and it is like some of the Indigo Girls material that you've written in that it is, I think it's a love song, fair
it's
to say.
It's definitely a love song.
But it's a love song about healing people who come together and can heal their wounds, which is such a theme of Indigo Girls songs.
Yes, it definitely is. So, I mean, there are just certain things that I believe about love and the ability to come together. And, of course, there are lots of brokenhearted love songs along the way. But, and that example is a song that when Kristen and I wrote that, it was very jangly poppy. And Lyris and I could not find an arrangement for it. We got into the studio and Lyris has just like put the brakes on the arrangement and said, look, let's just try something different. Start from beginning. Just do something groovy. The bass player started with some effects on his bass, Tim LaFave. And he created the bed for the song, and then it's got an Armenian instrument called a duduk on it, which is a wind instrument, so plaintive to me, one of my favorites. And then I sang the whole thing in my head voice, and I kept asking, is this okay? Do you think this is okay?
What do you mean your head voice?
Like way up here instead of this, like no pushing, no any of that, no chest voice. And we made a conscious decision not to put any harmony on it. I was like, shouldn't we put some harmony? And Lyris is like, nope. Leave it like it is, bare, naked, and groovy, and all that stuff. So that song went on quite a journey, but it started with me and Kristen, my Atlanta peeps.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
You have offered to perform one of the songs from this record in the studio live. You brought your guitar, which
I did.
Love. And I'm excited about this. And the song I asked you if you'd be willing to play is 331, but there's a good story behind 331 that it would be great to have you tell before you sing it.
Well, 331, as those of you who go down to anywhere near Panama City know, is a road that runs down there through Florida, and you have to get on it for the most part to get down to the beach there. And there's a lot of Atlanta folks that go down there, that stretch between Panama City and Destin. And I have been going there for, close to 35 years maybe. And so it's exploded. But anyway, I'm that kind of person who could just sit on a beach and not think about, you know, put the umbrella in my drink and go, let's just totally chill. Because I think about when the Seminoles lived down there and took care of the land. And I think about the oil spill that was so devastating, not only to the sea, but the fishing communities and ethnic communities down there. So I'm kind of a mixed bag. I like to have a good time and chill, but I've always got these things on my mind.
Well, I love this song, and I wanted you to play it because everybody in Georgia has gone down 331 to the sand. Here's Emily Saliers.
331 to the sand. 331 to the sand. I'm gonna go back to Florida, resurrect my band. Before the road is sand. sand. Things got along better when the Seminoles held the land. Caretakers gotta take care, singers gotta sing. Troy Elba, Kinston, Devoniac Springs, they take me to my favorite things, yeah.
You are getting closer to fine every day.
That was a good one.
That's a great song. Thank you so much for playing that with it. So that's music from Murmuration Nation, your first solo album, available now wherever records are sold.
That's true.
Let's take another break. Back in a moment with Emily Saliers. This is Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. Let's get back to my conversation with Emily Saliers. She's one half of the singer-songwriter team, the Indigo Girls. Now Emily has released her first solo record called Murmuration Nation. Can we talk about your life?
Of course, Bill. I'm going to pull up a chair.
Good. You have an interesting family. Your grandfather was Hal Saliers?
Yep.
He was described in one article I read about him as a Midwestern hep cat.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, who moved to New York in the 20s. He was a saxophone player, violinist. He played with Jack Teagarden, Paul Whiteman Orchestra, but he also had a difficult life, didn't he?
He did. I mean, when he passed away, he had been a recovering alcoholic for decades, you know? So that's a beautiful thing to pass on in recovery. It's a very powerful thing. So, but he, like, you know, he had four wives and he was out on the road, and my dad's mom passed away when he was only five. So it was difficult for my dad, you know, with regards to my grandpa. And then when my grandpa was sober and we'd spend some time around him and he'd bring out a saxophone or play the piano, and I'd be like, Grandpa's so grumpy. I was like, Grandpa's so grumpy. He was kind of a curmudgeon, you know, but very gifted.
But there was a transformative moment in his difficult life. He was asked to lead a church.
A small church, yeah, musical group. And that really anchored him in his sobriety as far as his human experience. And then my dad, you know, my dad was playing jazz, and grandpa would be like, cut out the fancy stuff, son, you know. And so they had that cool relationship. And then my dad, of course, got called to theology. Otherwise, I think he would have been a performing artist as well. He's a very fine pianist, and he plays the organ, and he writes sacred music. So,
yeah, your dad, he's as well, in some ways, he's as well known in this community as you are.
Yeah.
He is one of the great leaders at the Candler School of Theology. He's a professor emeritus,
mm-hmm.
Don Saliers. You two wrote a book together. A Life to Live, Reflections on Music as Spiritual Practice. And you talk about Saturday night music, which is your music, and Sunday morning music, which is his, right?
Yeah, and it was a wonderful journey writing this book with my dad. And first of all, because it was a religious press, you know, I had to have a lot of conversations with dad about my fear because of the queer community had suffered such pain, injustice, alienation from organized religious communities. So we had to work through that together before I even spoke my first word about what I wanted in the book. But what we both acknowledged, and my dad is very progressive. He just turned 80, and he's inspiring me to no end. He's open and inspired and still learning. So anyway, you know, we talked about how when Amy and I played at Little Five Points Pub, and it was a motley crew. It was people who were strung out, and it was people from different bands, and it was people who were lonely and people who had community. And so healing was the musical force that that bonded us all together. And you want nothing more than music in church to bond you to community and connect you to a higher spirit. And so we started talking about the similarities rather than the differences.
You've said at one point, music is the language of the soul made audible, and it's also a deep part of our physicality, our heartbeat, the sound of our breath, the tension and release of muscles, the tempo of our bodies. It's the rhythm of life moving within us as well as moving us from the outside. And then you go on, and this is relevant, to say it doesn't have to occur in church to be spiritual. So let's separate those for a second. You feel music as one of the most vital forces in your life.
Undeniably. I think it's as basic as a human experience as eating or breathing, or I believe that we need music. But it follows the physiological patterns of space and flow and heart, the rhythm of the heartbeat. And so it's viscerally a physiological force. And then not to mention what it does to your brain and what it releases that makes you feel good when you listen to it.
You told an interviewer, you say, is there just a plain and simple message of love and caring for each other and the world? And you say there are some so-called secular texts that speak to that with more passion and power than some of the most well-known sacred texts. And this is sort of what you and your father, in your shared love of music playing together, have tried to understand how both sacred and secular music can speak to the same most important parts of who we ought to strive to be as people.
Yes, and you know, I stopped using the term secular and sacred, really, because there was such a intersection of them throughout our discussions, and now what I believe in life, you know, and what I've seen, and how, and the basic thing is to not judge works of art or prose or sacred works, but to respect the fact that they move people's spirits to either be better people, to put that very simply and sort of clunkily, bigly. And just to, I am always a believer in the unexamined life is not worth living. So all of these texts and these sources, whether they be deemed sacred or secular, are all deepening our human experience. And that's the point, you know. I believe there's a point to why we're here. I respect other people who don't believe that, but I just time and time again, I'm reminded of the awesomeness of why we're here.
If you don't mind, I want to go back a little bit in time. I found a video of you and your dad performing together. It's not the greatest quality recording that I couldn't find a better one. But I do think it's worth listening to just a little bit of it.
Please join to our door and listen.
That is so sweet.
You know what, though? Those lyrics are, they take into account the darkness of the world.
Yeah.
And in fact, Amy and I recorded that song on our holiday album.
Which your dad was a part of, right? He went
played
up to
the
Nashville.
Piano. He played the piano. He'd never been in a studio like that before.
He's tried in the sleep of the night, in the dark before light. You come, in the silence of stars, in the violence of wars.
He nailed it, you know, which is not the nicest term to use for a beautiful piece of music like that, but he did. And he just did the greatest job. And I brought that song. Amy, Dad introduced me to that song, Peace Child.
What is that song?
It's called Peace Child. And my dad introduced me to that song because he loved the way it's so beautiful harmonically, so sweet. And yet all of the text takes into account the difficulties of the human world, wars and suffering. And so I brought it to Amy, and I'm like, I think you'll love this song, and I think it'll do well on our, will fit our holiday album. She loved it immediately. And Amy's dad had sung on Dead Man's Hill back on that album. So Dad was kind of always bucking for a place on an Indigo Girls record. He wanted a harpsichord solo. That never worked out. But he did come and play the piano on Peace Child, and so that song has even deeper meaning for me in my own experience because of that.
I cannot tell you. I didn't have the kind of relationship with my father that you have to this day with yours. And it's just so powerful to recognize how tight, close that bond is. Your dad, back when you were touring on the book, you went to a big convocation out in, I think, at the Anaheim Convention Center.
Yeah.
And your dad said something. He said, I love my Bach, but pointing to you, but your stuff has taught me so much. What does he mean by that?
You know, he's a classical pianist, and he loves classical music and probably some jazz more than any other genre of music. But I think that the Indigo Girls lyrics and through our discussions, he's just learned about struggle through the lyrics and through the observations. And so, you know, Bach is, we had discussions like, Dad, you've got to give Madonna her props. This one song changed my friend's life. He was a trucker and he pulled over in Ray of Light. He just wept. And I said, because he's like, you know, you can't compare that to Bach, and you can't compare it structurally, musically, and the brilliance of Bach, but you can't deny the emotional impact on a human being's life, whether it's Madonna or whether it's Bach. And I think those are some of the things that he's talking about in what we've taught him.
Your father was asked at one point to do an updated version of the Methodist hymnal, right?
I'm very proud of him for that, yeah.
What are the songs? What's a song?
Oh, you know, like, well, I know In the Bleak Midwinter is in there. That was my mom's favorite holiday.
So,
in the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. That was also on the Indigo Girls holiday record. For the beauty of the earth, and all the Christmas songs.
But here's one of the songs that your dad wanted to be part of that hymnal.
Lord, dear Lord of love, God, God up above, please look down and see my people through.
That happens to be Mahalia Jackson singing the great Duke Ellington's Come Sunday.
And if that's not a hymn, I don't know what a hymn is. And that was what my dad set out to dig deeper into, songs that, hymns that really are hymns, and include also hymns that are sung in Spanish and hymns that take into account gender, language, and just he's just comprehensive like that in seeking out what moves the human spirit. And he plays, when Dad and I do our performances together, he does a version of that with the Duke, you know.
Wow.
With the big jazz chords, and his is less reflective than Mahalia's version, Mahalia Jackson's version, respect to her. And so it's my favorite, actually my favorite part of our performances together when he brings the Duke to life, and it's a hymn.
Oh, it's a beautiful piece of music.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned briefly the queer community and some of your concerns. I think there was a time, if we were having this conversation 5 or 6 years ago, as I look back at some of the interviews that you and Amy have done over the years, the question of the gay and lesbian community probably would have been one of the first things we would have talked about. It is my sense as a straight man that we have achieved a place where that isn't the first thing to talk about in terms of your life anymore. Am I right about that?
You are right about that. And I some of it is due to change that has actually happened. And some of it is due to the fact that we've just talked about it so long that everybody just knows it, you know. But honestly, there have been changes that have been made. I'll say that without you know, denying that the queer teenage suicide rate is higher than any other demographic. And you know, the way that the transgender community suffers through violence and being ostracized and, you know.
That's kind of I don't know if it's a final frontier, but it's the next frontier in understanding gender.
I couldn't agree with you more. And so it's important. And so just taking that into account, as far as gays and lesbians and, you know, honestly, Bill, I never thought that I would get to get married in this country. I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime. Then comes a president named Obama. And federal protection. And so my wife, who's Canadian, we thought we'd have to move to Canada, honestly. And we were talking about that and sort of making tentative plans. And then the federal government said, you can get married. And, you know, we went to City Hall in New York and got married. And it changed my life.
How long have you been married now?
Well, how long ago did that happen? Like three years?
Emily, you've got to remember your anniversary.
Oh, I remember the anniversary, but I can't remember. I think it's, I don't know, like 3 years ago.
Okay.
We already had our, we already had our daughter because we were going to move ahead being a family, even though we wouldn't be, you know, legislatively validated. But, and so there have been a lot of changes. So Amy and I, we're known as queer lesbians. We're known as queer people and activists, and I'm grateful for that. There was a time around 1990 when the national press came in and started asking, and I was so afraid. And then we got over that hump. I wouldn't trade it for anything, being part of the community and the movement early on.
Yeah. I'm glad that we can now bring that. I might not even have brought it up if you hadn't mentioned it in passing.
Right.
I do fear, and I don't want to minimize the fact that for younger people coming out, accepting who they are can still be a tremendously difficult challenge.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people are kicked out of their homes and their churches, and they've had strong faith communities. This is happening with particular interest in the Mormon communities. I know because my wife grew up in a Mormon household, and just, you know, just a lot of being ostracized and the pain. And it's not just the Mormon church. It's any organized church that holds fast to these very conservative tenets. Which I don't believe. And so, you know, the struggle continues, but we've come a long way, and we have to acknowledge that.
Was it ever a struggle for you with your family? I mean, your father and mother seem to be two of the most accepting people in the universe. So was it ever a problem for either you or Amy?
No, well, it was harder for Amy than it was for me, but by the time Amy told her parents, her oldest sister was gay, and she went through the hardest of that because it was a long time ago, and but my family, my parents knew. I mean, when my mom made my sister's Easter dresses, I must have been five, I asked for Easter pants. And she respected that and made me Easter pants. We have the pictures to prove it. And when I told them, they weren't surprised. And my mom was so sweet when I told her. It was more my own internal agony over, I don't want to mess this family up. You know, we're good kids. I'm the black sheep, blah, blah, blah. This is all a bunch of BS. But anyway, the first thing my mom said was, well, when I was in college, I had a crush on one of my women professors. And I was like, oh, my God, This is why I don't judge people who have trouble coming out due to their circumstances, because I was blessed with a family like that, and most people aren't.
Can we talk a little Indigo Girls?
Always.
Always. How have you two, I know you get this question, you've known each other since elementary school. Where did you go to school?
Laurel Ridge Elementary.
Laurel Ridge, yep. In DeKalb County?
DeKalb County.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And then you were in high school together.
Shamrock High School.
Shamrock. How has this worked? You're now approaching 95, 05, 50. You're well over 30, 40 years together, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. How does it keep working, Emily?
There's a lot of reasons. One is that we are yin and yang, so there's that sort of mysterious coming together of opposites.
How are you opposites?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Amy's a vegetarian, and she has to be in the country. I'm a little more urban. I'm not a vegetarian. She would shop at thrift stores. Yeah, I've been known to dip into Barney's a few times. She makes very quick decisions and is kind of, I think she can be at times kind of scary to certain people who don't know just her very direct way. I'm a little more softer around the edges.
Yeah, you just are one of these people who you just throw your arms out and say, come to me, my people.
Yeah, for better or for worse. You know, you talk about that introvert thing, though, after a show's done. If they say, come to me, my people, I'm like, nope, I'm going on the bus and getting in my bunk. But Amy and I, and she's much more punk-influenced, you know, rock and roll. She strums the guitar hard. I'm a picker. Joni Mitchell was my biggest influence. But anyway, we have survived. Not just survived, we love what we do. I love it more than ever because we give each other space. We respect the gifts that we bring to Indigo Girls. We know that we're better together than separate. We don't hang out together. And we're both, our social activism comes from the same place with the same depth of passion. And that's about it in a nutshell. It's a lot of things, but it's, I love Amy like family and she loves me like family. We just love each other.
I love that. When I go to an Indigo Girls concert, now when I get to see you doing a solo record, there's something undefinable about the way the songs that you and Amy perform that reaches the audience in an indefinably special way. There's something about the way you bring people together as a community. It's almost metaphysical. Do you relate to what I'm saying, or is that just blabbing?
I mean, I would call it metaphysical, and I have an experience of this. I experience this as a fan of other artists as well, and so I think it's, you know, obviously not just Indigo Girls, but also I think for the people who listen to our music, they take the music into their lives, and so it becomes conjoined with their experiences and journeys and events, you know, milestones. And so when you bring your history into a room, and then you get to sing and... It's just me and Amy up there the same way as when we were at Little Five Points Pub. We're just standing up there, you know, like we don't even dress nicely. You know, it's just like here we all are and here's the music and it's cool.
Can we play a little Indigo Girls?
Of course.
You okay with that?
Of course. I have to say, Bill, there would be no solo album without Indigo Girls. So,
are you talking about just being able to do the record itself, raise the money?
Yeah,
get the band?
Yeah, and just acknowledge Indigo Girls' music, even in the course of this, you know, solo journey. So, sorry to interrupt.
You can interrupt me anytime.
Can you play Indigo Girls? You can always play Indigo Girls.
You know, I want to play one song if I can. You talk about how people. You think one of the reasons that you've been fortunate enough to be treated as special. Because people bring your music home with them into their houses, and it's part of their lives. Swampophilia, which is such a great, great record, came out like 1989, 1990,
it was after
or later,
that.
Actually.
Yeah.
No, it was later.
Maybe 94-ish, something in there.
So I have to tell you that that record was the musical soundtrack of my courtship with my wife.
Ah.
And... it's hard for me to even talk about without choking up a little
bit.
That's
so cool.
And you know which song it was. One of your songs.
Power of Two.
Can we listen to just a little bit?
Of course.
Of Power of Two?
Pick you up. like to drive way out in the country. 5 miles out of the city limit, we're singing and your hands upon my knee.
Let's do the chorus.
So we're okay, we're fine. Baby, I'm here to stop your crying. Chase all the ghosts from your head. I'm stronger than the monster beneath your bed. Smarter than the tricks played on your heart. Look at them together and we'll take them apart. Adding up the total of a love that's true. Multiply life by the power of two.
This is like the most fun I've had in a long time.
I wanted to do that because that's what happens at every one of your shows. When you two play a concert together, that audience comes together as one and celebrates you and your music in such a powerful way. I couldn't imagine that song without us joining in on the chorus.
Right. It's a wonderful thing. I mean, some of it, you know, like when we write choruses with melodies that you can sing to. That helps the whole process. But it is. I mean, it's just there. Well, where else can you get together and sing in public anymore besides your houses of worship or maybe now and then a community center? But there is just something extremely powerful about people getting together and singing together. You know, if you sing in key or not, who cares? It's just your...
Wait, was that a comment on me?
No, absolutely. Of course not, Bill. You're right on. And of course, your wife, Janice, has joined
Janice
us.
Yeah, Janice is sitting here because I asked her if she would help us with the chorus of that song. What was that like?
Pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
I love me some Emily.
When I go to a concert, I sing my head off the whole time.
Yeah.
I love it.
Emily Saliers, your new album is Murmuration Nation, and it's got just such wonderful songs on it.
Thank you.
And of course, for many years, we've been so happy to have you and Amy as part of this community as the Indigo Girls. It's been just a thrill to have you here today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Bill, for your thoughtful questions. It is a real pleasure.
Emily's Murmuration Nation tour is taking her to venues around the country. But on October 21st, you can see her here in Atlanta. She'll be playing the Buckhead Theater with a new band she's assembled for her tour. We've posted a link to more information about that show and the touring schedule on our website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. We've also posted a link to a couple of videos of starling murmurations, those fantastical flying formations of birds that gave Emily the idea for a song and for a title for the new record. They really are amazing to see. We're just about out of time today, but I want to remind you that while we love having you join us when we're on the radio, you can find us in other ways too. You can subscribe to the Two-Way Street podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and we keep an archive of all of our shows on our website.
There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line.
Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Jenny edited today's show. Olivia Rheingold is our associate producer. Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. And I hope to see you again next week for another edition of Two-Way Street.
With a poster of Rasputin and a beer down to his knee. He never did marry or see a big, great movie. He graded my performance. He said he could sit down.